Should you stay or should you go? Today, Monday, July 7th, this is The World. I'm Marco Werman. The U.S. State Department regularly issues travel warnings for Americans. Want to guess what's currently considered dangerous?
The U.S. State Department is saying that U.S. citizens should strongly consider not going to more than one-third of Africa.
Lots of African countries don't like that. But this State Department official says countries like Kenya shouldn't take the travel warnings personally.
They are simply a reflection, and a very factual, very objective reflection of the security situation as we and our experts see it.
Plus, Jamaican guitarist Brushy One String finds that less is more.
And people was like, hey, there's a new madman in town, and he plays a one-string guitar. And I was like, yeah. And from that, the rest is history, man.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, celebrating people living with medical technology who are giving back to their communities. Apply for the Bakken Invitation Award and earn a $20,000 charitable grant for your charity. Learn more at liveongiveon.org.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. I hear Ukraine is beautiful this time of year, but the U.S. State Department advises against going to Ukraine right now, like some 35 other countries around the globe. Ukraine is on the State Department's travel warning list. There's a live conflict there right now, so that's what that's about. In a moment, more on what's happening in Ukraine today and a possible change of fortunes for Kyiv. But first, travel warnings, since it's summer. Travel warnings are the strongest way the U.S. can encourage its citizens not to visit a country without ordering an all-out travel ban. Those warnings got the world's own David Conrad thinking. David's our Google Journalism Fellow and is with us in the world's newsroom this summer. And he's just produced an infographic about travel warnings and one intriguing trend.
So 4 years ago, when South Africa first hosted the World Cup, there was a big push toward improving the global image of Africa. And a lot of energy was put into attracting more tourists, not just to South Africa, but across the continent. So my initial interest was quite basically in whether or not this had happened and whether this World Cup's moment of hope and positivity actually resulted in an improved reputation of Africa 4 years later. Now, obviously, this is a big question that I couldn't provide any definitive answer to, but two indicators that I thought were quite revealing and which I decided to look at for this story were U.S. travel warnings, since they, at the very least, help shape American perceptions of places abroad, and travel to Africa by U.S. citizens.
How far back did you start looking as to these travel warnings for Africa, the African continent specifically?
I started in looking at 1996 and then looked at every year from that point forward. And I looked at the first week of June of each year to try and understand going into the summer what this travel warning list looked like.
Right. So what kind of trends have you seen since 1996 with travel to Africa?
Now, I can't draw any direct correlation. And tourism data certainly has a number of limitations, but it is clear that there are more African nations on the travel warning list now than there were 4 years ago and several more than there were 10 years ago or in 1996. In fact, what I think is probably the most striking is that based on the list, the U.S. State Department is saying that U.S. citizens should strongly consider not going to more than one-third of Africa.
Wow, a third of the continent.
Right. And at the same time, travel to Africa by U.S. citizens has decreased every year since the 2010 World Cup. And so it's hard not to wonder whether the travel warnings could be a contributing factor in this decline.
So what are some of the questions that you still would like answered from digging around this data?
I think what is most troubling to me is how vague the criteria seem to be. Kenyans have become quite vocal this summer in being frustrated that the list is causing tourists not to travel to the country. And then you have this tiny Central African nation of Burundi, where I found there hasn't been a single terrorism attack on an American in more than a decade. But it, too, is still on the list, simply because there was a threat that an attack could take place. So I guess regardless of whether or not we can draw a direct correlation between the declining tourism to Africa or to a negative perception of the continent among U.S. citizens, I'm just left with a very basic question of why and how these travel warnings are created.
That was David Conrad, our Google Journalism Fellow here at The World. You can see his fascinating infographic about travel warnings at PRI.org. Now, those questions he brought up, the why and the how the travel bans are created, we wanted to investigate that further, so we're turning to Michelle Bernier-Toth. She's the Managing Director for Overseas Citizen Services at the State Department. She oversees the day-to-day operations of the State Department office that handles international travel warnings. So according to the State Department, a third of Africa now has a travel advisory. I mean, that's a lot of territory. How do you actually go about making these decisions?
The decision on whether to issue a travel warning is a very collaborative process. It's based on information, first of all, from our embassies and consulates overseas in the country, in this case in African countries, who are assessing the security situation on the ground. And they're feeding that information back to Washington. We're taking in information from local governments, from the intelligence and security community, from the media, wherever we can get it. We then do an assessment in Washington as to what this means for traveling U.S. citizens and issue a travel warning, or in some cases a travel alert, based on that information.
Now, for example, Cameroon just got on the list because of a couple of kidnappings. Give us some examples of other reasons why warnings, travel advisors are created.
Kidnappings would be a very good example when it is a chronic problem that affects people very frequently. Very high rates of crime. You see that not just in some of the African countries like Kenya, but also in certain Latin American countries that have recently instituted travel warnings. Or the threat of terrorist action, whether it's specifically directed at U.S. citizens or Western interests, or just in general where you could be in the wrong place at the wrong time.
How long do these travel advisories last? And when a country does land on one of these lists, what do they have to do to get off the list?
Travel warnings, they do not have any particular expiration date. We will lift them when we deem that the security situation or the conditions that led to the travel warning no longer exist. And so there have been instances where we have determined that, for example, a government's efforts to combat terrorism have been extremely successful and that they have things under control and we were able to lift the ban.
Now, Michelle, as you may know, Kenya says it doesn't deserve to be on this current list, that it plays into the extremist group's hands. What would you say to Kenyans who say that this is not warranted?
There are, governments don't like to have travel warnings imposed. But our point is that travel warnings are not a reflection of the bilateral relationship we enjoy with the host government. They are simply a reflection and a very factual, very objective reflection of the security situation as we and our experts see it.
And for countries that get put on these lists, what are the consequences over the long term? What have you found?
I think we generally note that it's not the travel warning in and of itself that has an impact, but the situation on the ground. And as I said, if we see an improvement in the security situation, we then will work to lift that travel warning or to modify the language so that it accurately reflects what's happening.
I mean, surely there are some consequences, though, for a country like Egypt. I mean, they rely so much on tourism that if those people stop going, it's going to hurt them, won't it?
Well, I would think that I know from colleagues in Cairo that, yes, tourism is down in Egypt, but it's probably less a reflection of our travel warning than of the general situation in Egypt.
What was the very first country that the State Department put on a travel warning list?
The farthest back that we could find anything resembling a travel warning was a 1914 message warning Americans in Europe of the impending war and inviting them to leave the region.
Do you have any sense of how many Americans in Europe heeded that warning to get out of Europe in World War One?
I don't, but it was in the thousands. There were some ships that were sent in to help people leave at that time.
Hmm. So John Jay, the first American U.S. Secretary of State, didn't issue a travel advisory about going
to
England,
to
watch out for those guys and that revolution thing.
He certainly didn't tweet it out.
What's your sense of how much Americans actually listen to these travel warnings? Do they pay attention?
I think they do. We hear about it from our contacts in the travel industry. We hear about it from private Americans. I hear about it from friends and family. I believe that increasingly people are paying attention. And I would note, paying attention not just to the U.S. travel information, but to that of other countries. Many other governments put out similar information. And we encourage people to compare, what we say as opposed to other countries to get a full picture of what's going on.
Michelle Bernier-Tote with the Overseas Citizen Services at the State Department. Thanks so much.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Again, you can see just where the State Department travel advisories are around the world. That infographic is at PRI.org. And while you're there, we're wondering about your travel plans. Do the advisories factor in? Have you visited or are you visiting a country on the no-go list? Let us know at PRI.org. And now about that trip to eastern Ukraine you probably won't be taking. The conflict there continues. This weekend, Ukrainian forces retook several eastern towns from pro-Russian rebels, including the stronghold of Slovyansk. The BBC's Oleksiy Solohubenko has just returned from the region, and I asked him, are the tides in this battle-torn country beginning to turn?
I think the tides are turning militarily. I think this is a very, very important turnaround for the Ukrainian army. And I think for the Ukrainian society, the one that supports the Ukrainian idea, supports the sovereignty of Ukraine, it's quite a big shift in terms of mood, in terms of operations on the ground, and in terms of actual achievement of the army. I think what they've done this time is not just recapture several cities, including the city of Slovyansk, a very iconic place for the pro-Russian rebels, but also forcing quite a large number of rebels, together with their military commander, Igor Strelkov, who is a Russian citizen, basically to flee. I think the casualties must have been quite substantial, even though we cannot confirm it. But they now move to Donetsk, and I think this is the next challenge, because Slovyansk was a city with a population about 100,000. Donetsk is 1 million plus. It's a very, very large place. So when I say militarily, it is an important turnaround. It's not the end of the story yet.
Mm. From what you saw, Oleksiy, when you were there, what evidence did you find that the pro-Russian citizens and locals in places like Luhansk and Donetsk are still supporting the rebels?
I don't think that we can talk about the widespread support. Over the weekend, the rebels in Donetsk, for instance, called for a mass rally. It wasn't quite a mass rally. I think, you know, several thousand people gathered, but this is nothing compared to the previous levels of support. And I spoke to a couple of people inside Donetsk, actually. The key concern is not so much the possible attack. They don't believe that there will be a mass strike by Ukrainian forces on the city, but the lawlessness and the lack of security in the city. In Slovyansk itself, the interesting thing that's happening, I guess, is that right behind the Ukrainian troops, there were truckloads of food, water.
Does that suggest there's a lack of food and water in these places?
In Slovyansk in particular, because it was under siege by the Ukrainian forces for quite a long time, there was a problem with food supplies.
So in Slovyansk, they're trying to bring in food and water. I hear that Ukrainian security officials are saying that they want to blockade Luhansk and Donetsk. I mean, what does that mean?
Well, that means a similar situation to what happened in Slovyansk. I think they said that the peaceful civilians can leave and they would open the corridors for them. But the rebels have two choices. One is to lay down their arms and surrender. Or the earlier proposal from President Poroshenko was that they can leave to Russia if they want. For the civilians, I think it's quite difficult because from what I hear from people on the ground, it was next to impossible to buy rail tickets because there was a limited service and many people didn't have enough money. And also some of the bridges around Donetsk have been blown up. So options are very, very limited for the civilians to leave.
Do you think things are going to shake out to the point where all of these alliances will be very clear and that the Ukrainian, truly Ukrainian part of the country will be unified?
Well, I think so, but I think it will never be the same because if you look at the logic of what President Putin wanted to achieve just 7 months ago when he managed to convince the then Ukrainian president not to sign the association agreement with the European Union, he wanted to bring Ukraine closer to Russia, to make it a more friendly state, to push it back from going west to Europe towards the United States. As a result of the annexation of Crimea and what was going on in eastern Ukraine with direct involvement and indirect involvement of the Russian Federation, I think the result is the opposite. Ukraine is more patriotic, more nationalistic, if you want, and it's much more anti-Russian. I think those friendly relations and open borders, absolutely free penetration of Russian media, Russian newspapers, Russian television into Ukraine, I think those days are gone. I think Ukraine will be much more cautious. And I think the feelings are hardened on both sides of the border. In Russia, I think the attitude toward Ukraine have also become much more negative. So whatever you think of Mr. Putin as the great strategist, so far the strategy has backfired quite badly because you don't have a friendly nation on your doorstep.
Oleksiy Soholubenko with the BBC, just back from Ukraine, speaking with us from London. Thank you.
Thank you.
A look now to a story we've got coming up. Everything you ever wanted to know about gestures that chimpanzees use to communicate. For example,
presenting the back sole of your foot to somebody to ask them to climb on your back, or, you know, offering an arm to be groomed.
Mm-hmm. News you can use if you happen to run into a chimp. I'm Marco Werman, and it's The World on your radio. Nelson Mandela, what more can you say about him that's not already been said? Just when you think there's nothing new to say, along comes Zelda LaGrange.
If you were born during the apartheid years and you were white in South Africa, you were born into privilege. Being a white South African, middle class, we had access to reasonably good education, schooling. We were a very ordinary Afrikaans family with certain rights because of the color of our skin. We lived apartheid, really.
LaGrange says she and her family lived in a bubble. She knew little about the struggle against apartheid, and even less about the man that much of the world recognized as the symbol of that struggle, Nelson Mandela.
The first time I heard his name was in February 1990 when he was released, and I was swimming. My dad came outside to the pool and he said, "Now we are in trouble." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "The terrorist is being released." I said, "What are you talking about?" He said, "Nelson Mandela." And I looked at him and I continued swimming. We didn't know much about this man other than what our schools and our churches taught us, and that is that this man represents the enemy. He is threatening your superiority.
When it was time for LaGrange to find a job, she went looking for work at the Capitol building in Pretoria because it was near her house.
I applied for a job in the ministry without portfolio in the presidency. And then while I was busy with the interview that day, the president's private secretary, who was Mary Ntladana, she came into the office and she said, "I need a typist right now." And I said, "Well, you know, I'm available." And they called me later to say, "Would you be interested in a position in the president's private office?" And I really didn't conceptualize what that could mean. I just thought, as long as it's in the union buildings, which is closer to my parents' home, I'll take anything.
She did take it. And here's where things get interesting. It was 1994. South Africa had recently elected its first black president. For LaGrange, he was basically some guy named Mandela.
Well, I was walking into his secretary's office, Mary, and as I walked into her office, this group of people came out of her office, and I nearly bumped into President Mandela. And suddenly this man appears in front of you, and he extends his hand, and I wasn't sure whether I'm supposed to greet him or not. And so I extend my hand, and I said, "Good morning, Mr. Mandela." And he spoke to me, and I couldn't understand a word he was saying. I had to ask him, "Please, excuse me, Mr. President, could you repeat that?" And when he repeated himself, I realized he was speaking to me in Afrikaans. He was speaking to me in my home language, the language of the oppressor, the last thing you expect of Nelson Mandela.
LaGrange would experience a lot of unexpected things working for Mandela.
At that stage, I was 24 years of age. Now, he was in prison for 27 years, so I felt, you know what, you don't even know what 27 years feel like, and your people sent this man to jail for 27 years. So you feel guilty, you feel responsible immediately as an Afrikaner standing there.
After 2 years as a typist, Zelda LaGrange was promoted, and then promoted again to the president's private secretary. She spent 19 years working with Mandela, or Gulu, as she came to call him, his personal assistant. The two became very close. The last time LaGrange saw Mandela was at his hospital bedside last year.
I said, "Hello, Gulu, this is Aldina. I've come to say hello to you." And his eyes just opened and he gave me the brightest, biggest smile. And I broke down in tears. It was just too much for me. But he fixed his eyes on me and he smiled. And Mrs. Mashala and Malinga joked and they said, "Madiba doesn't afford other people that kind of smile, but to you he smiles." So they teased me. But because that's the most recent memory of him, that's very vivid in my mind.
Zelda LaGrange, Aldina, as she was known to Nelson Mandela, told her story to the BBC's Outlook program. She's written a book about her experiences. It's called Good Morning, Mr. Mandela, the first words she said to him at that first meeting with the president in 1994. You may recall the story of Coco the gorilla, who's learned sign language and could understand many words in English, but that was a case of humans teaching a gorilla a human form of language. Now some researchers who've spent years studying chimpanzees in Uganda have put together what they call a lexicon of gestures that chimps use to communicate with one another. Catherine Hobater of the University of St. Andrews led the research, and she spoke with my colleague Carol Hills about what the gestures mean.
Some of the gestures are something that would be very intuitively familiar for a human, raising your arm in the air or reaching out your hand in front of somebody. Some of them are a little less intuitive, so presenting the back sole of your foot to somebody, just ask them to climb on your back, or, you know, offering an arm to be groomed. There's 66 different gestures, so there's a great variety that chimps have to choose from.
What distinguishes these gestures from, say, you know, a dog wagging its tail when it wants a walk? What makes this different?
Almost all animals use physical movements, facial expressions, calls to communicate. But what makes chimpanzee and really all great ape gestures unique is that they're what we call intentional or purposeful. The chimpanzees actually have a goal in mind that they're gesturing to achieve, and they're gesturing to a specific other recipient. So this isn't just them broadcasting information to the world. It's always a little hard to compare it with cats and dogs because they're domesticated and we've bred them for so long to respond to our own language. But wild animals in general don't really do this kind of purposeful communication. So chimpanzee gestures are the only other system that's language-like in that kind of meaningful way.
Were you observing the same group of chimps? Were there different groups and they all seem to use the same gestures?
We've just observed one group of chimps at the moment in terms of interpreting the meaning. We've looked across lots of different chimpanzee groups and lots of different ape groups in terms of which gestures are there. So we know that the gestures available seem to be shared by everybody. But what they're used for, the meanings of those gestures, you know, you might have a kind of gesture dialect difference between, say, East and West Africa.
How many chimps were you observing?
The Sonso community has about 80 individuals in it, from newborn babies to 60-year-old grandfathers.
I'm still not clear on the intentional versus non-intentional. Give me an example of a non-intentional gesture that a chimp might make, and then an intentional gesture.
Okay. When they come across a snake in the forest, they give a couple of different alarms, and one or two of them are not intentional. They seem to give them whether they're on their own or with others, but there's a single one that they give in a very directed way to other individuals.
Can you demonstrate it for us?
They give a very soft, ooh, kind of noise.
So that's the intentional versus a ooh, ooh.
The loud, much more perhaps emotionally immediate responses that they give didn't seem to be intentional.
Just a quick final question. I want to picture you out there in Uganda observing these chimps. What's the setting?
Well, I'm probably sitting under a tree looking slightly exasperated because I've been waiting for them to come down for 3 hours when they've been sitting up there in their nest. And then they'll pop down the tree and disappear off through the forest. And I have to keep up with them, tracking over trees and through swamps and trying to avoid getting too many army ant bites on the way. And then hopefully come across them when they've, you know, relaxed somewhere underneath a big fruit tree and they're feeding and you see the little ones playing and a couple of the adults grooming. And that gives me a great opportunity to just sort of sit down quietly somewhere and film the behavior going on.
Do they know you at this point?
Yes, they definitely know me as an individual. I've worked with this particular community now for over 8 years. So especially some of the younger ones, they've just grown up with me following them. And as tempting as it is to want to be able to interact with them, I really try very hard not to.
That's Catherine Hobater speaking with the world's Carol Hills. You can hear more of that conversation in our podcast, The World in Words, including what Hobater thinks her research tells us about the origin of human language. This is The World on PRI Public Radio International. I'm Marco Werman. Just ahead, a reporter takes stock of the late Eduard Shevardnadze and his role in taking Georgia from communism to democracy.
To Georgia at the time, he was really the man, the only man who could deliver Georgia from the chaos that it was in.
Plus, guess how many strings Brushy One Strings got on his guitar? Go on, take a guess.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, celebrating people living with medical technology who are giving back to their communities. Apply for the Bakken Invitation Award and earn a $20,000 charitable grant for your charity. Learn more at liveongiveon.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. In a place where tensions generally run high, these are unusually tense times in the Mideast. Israeli police have arrested 6 people in connection with last week's brutal murder of a Palestinian teenager. Mohammed Abu Qader, who was 16, was abducted and burned to death. That was soon after the discovery of the bodies of 3 kidnapped Israeli teenagers in the West Bank. Qader's killing set off days of rioting in Palestinian neighborhoods in the West Bank and Jerusalem. Earlier, I spoke with Shira Frankel, Middle East correspondent with BuzzFeed, and she said the suspects in the Palestinian teen's death are apparently connected with a well-known group of right-wing Israeli soccer hooligans.
The Bitar Jerusalem soccer team is very popular in Israel. It has a lot of fans. But within those fans, there's a very small group called La Familia. And I don't really think it's any coincidence that they chose the name La Familia with those kind of mafia undertones. They're known as a very hardcore, very extreme sort of core fandom within that soccer league who go to games and chant all sorts of racist slogans. For a long time, the Bitar Jerusalem soccer team only had Jewish players, and they were really proud of that. They exulted in the fact that they were an all-Jewish team. And in 2013, when the team did decide to bring on two Muslim Chechenian players, the first game they played, they unfurled a slogan talking about the pure Jewish race, which of course to many people were called some of the Nazi slogans. They made those players' life an absolute hell and rioted to the point where they set fire to the team manager's office. So these core group of fans are well known to police. They've acted out in the past. They've acted out specifically against Arabs and Palestinians. And it actually came as a surprise to very few people that they would be tied to this murder.
Although it's surprising to me, and I imagine a lot of our listeners, you know, whether they're called La Familia or hooliganism around the world is known as, you know, the people who carry it out as ultras, they can be pretty brutal. So Israel's got its own group of ultras.
Exactly. And these people, the six people who were arrested, already had police files. Their names were well known. One of the police officers that I spoke to yesterday in an off-record briefing said, I'm surprised they didn't do this sort of thing before. They had it in them. They came from a sort of ideology and a way of thinking where this is, you know, acting out against Palestinians, taking matters into your own hands was the way to handle things. And he said, we're lucky that this didn't happen sooner. And now that it's happened, we need the full weight of the law brought against them.
So with the murder of those three Israeli teenagers, I mean, that drama had Israel absolutely riveted. What's been the reaction among Israelis to what appears now to be a revenge killing, possibly by these soccer hooligans?
There's a range, there's a spectrum of how Israelis are responding to this. There's quite a few who say, oh, you know, this revenge killing is a group of extreme religious, you know, fanatics, and they have nothing to do with us, and they don't represent us, and they're such a small, little, extreme minority of Israel, and so on and so forth. And then there are others who say this should be a time of reckoning for Israel, this should be a time of reckoning for both Israelis and Palestinians, and to look at sort of their leadership, to look at the lack of a peace process and say, is this where this leads us? Is this where this road goes?
And if this is a hopeful, soul-searching moment, is it also a moment for Israelis to worry about, you know, ultras taking the law into their own hands now?
Yes, very much. And today in the Israeli city of Bet Shemesh, which is just south of Jerusalem, I met with a group of those hardcore fans. And when I asked them, you know, has this caused you to reconsider your positions? They said, absolutely not. We hope this is the first of many. These guys represent us and what we think. And we think that Arabs have killed us for long enough. And us, by they meant Jews. And we're quite proud of their actions. They showed very little remorse or very little concern for what was happening. And in fact, seemed almost bolstered, I would say, by the very grisly murder of Muhammad Abu Khadir.
Yeah, well, it feels like tit for tat now. There's been another round of violence between Israel and the Gaza Strip in recent days. Palestinian militants are firing rockets into Israel, and the Israeli military has carried airstrikes in Gaza. I mean, where is all this headed, Shira?
You know, the fears on the ground are that it's heading nowhere good. A friend I spoke with in Gaza just a few hours ago said that people there are already preparing for another full-on Israeli offensive. I think people on both sides are hoping it doesn't go that far, at least not again. But there's a great deal of concern that that's exactly where this is heading.
Shira, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Shira Frankel, Middle East correspondent with BuzzFeed there, speaking with me from Jerusalem. Remember when the United States and the former Soviet Union were deeply suspicious of each other? The Cold War and the West couldn't trust the East and they couldn't trust the West, you know, just like now. Seriously, though, I'm thinking of the last gasps of the Soviet Union at the end of the Cold War and the players who seemed to pop onto the cover of Time magazine almost weekly in the late 80s. You'll remember Mikhail Gorbachev. There was also Boris Yeltsin. And then there was Eduard Shevardnadze. He died today at the age of 86. Shevardnadze was the Soviet foreign minister that Washington could deal with, an eloquent white-haired diplomat at Gorbachev's side and later the president of the Republic of Georgia, forced out ultimately by a peaceful revolution. Our friend at the BBC, Natalia Antalava, interviewed Shevardnadze several times, including once at the end of his political career in 2003.
I went up to his mansion, which he managed to keep after he was ousted from power. He still got to keep his presidential palace, and he had aged incredibly through the revolution. I was very struck by how he really wanted to avoid talking about the end of his government. What he really wanted to focus on was his legacy in the post-Soviet era, so things that Georgians really didn't care all that much about at that point. And he talked about, you know, his role in ending the Cold War. We talked about Afghanistan and his role in pulling the troops out of Afghanistan. He talked about his all his Western friends, the Germans, who still very much credit him for reunification of Germany, his relationship with Reagan, and so on. Another thing that really struck me was just how lonely he seemed, and he did actually say, "I'm very lonely these days." So to go from that glorious career as the foreign minister of the USSR to being really an old, lonely man on top of a hill overlooking a city that no longer wanted him or needed him is quite a journey.
And politically, Natalia, do you think that quote he gave you, "I'm a communist, became a Democrat," did he resist a temptation to become a dictator?
He was undoubtedly a visionary who saw the weaknesses of the Soviet Union and, together with Gorbachev, worked towards transforming the Soviet Union. And that's something you can't really take away from him. And he also had a great deal of courage, both political in terms of taking massive political risks and coming back to Georgia after the collapse of the Soviet Union was one of those risks, and also personal courage as well. I mean, I remember watching him on television as a child, walking into, you know, extremely dangerous, hostile situations, talking to people and so on. At the same time, he certainly wasn't strong enough to prevent the corruption and nepotism that flourished around him. But I think there was a genuine shift that happened within him that he recognized. And it was during that interview that he said to me, "It was tempting for me many times to slam my fist against the table and say no and become a dictator. And I didn't do that. And that to me is the biggest achievement of my life."
What is your strongest memory of growing up in Georgia, in Shevardnadze's Georgia?
I remember very clearly the winter of 1992, which was the worst winter of any Georgian's life, I think. It was the height of the civil war. The city was burning. There was no electricity. There was no food, really. There was schools were shut down. Hospitals didn't work. And I remember a telephone ringing in our very dark and very cold apartment and my mom picking up the phone. And it was my father who was calling with the news that the rumors have been flying around that Shevardnadze was coming back to lead Georgia. And I remember that transformation on my mother's face to that hope that, oh, God, maybe suddenly, you know, he was to Georgia at the time. He was really the man, the only man who could deliver Georgia from the chaos that it was in. And it's really interesting that the disappointment that he had eventually brought was just as great, greater perhaps, than that hope that came with him when he returned to Georgia in 1992.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I don't want to let you go without mentioning the fact you're from Georgia. Shevardnadze was too. And oddly, for the first time today in your life, you are in Atlanta, Georgia. Must be kind of weird. Have you had any moments of confusion yet?
Weird indeed. It was very confusing to turn on a local TV network and find out that Shevardnadze was dead in Georgia.
The BBC's Natalia Antalava, as they say, in Georgia. Thank you all for your time.
Thank you.
I don't know about you, but I'm actually kind of glad there's a pause in World Cup action today. It'll calm all of us down, and maybe some of this nail-biting anxiety can recede a bit. Until tomorrow in the first semifinal match, when Germany meets Brazil, the technical game versus the beautiful game, yes. An amazing tourney so far, especially for those lucky enough to see the games in Brazil. There is nothing quite like watching soccer, any sport really, in the stadium or ballpark. The crowd, the green grass, the charged atmosphere of competition. But if you're a woman living in Iran, you don't get to experience any of that. The world's own Shirin Jafari grew up in Iran, and she knows what it's like.
It's a nice summer afternoon here in Massachusetts. I am at a stadium at a soccer match. There's a game going on between the Massachusetts team and also a team from Philadelphia. Now, I would not be able to do this exact same thing if I was in Iran. Where I'm from, women are not allowed to go to stadiums to watch sports. That's been true since the 1979 Islamic Revolution. Female sports fans can't cheer for the teams inside stadiums. They can only watch on TV. And right now, the topic is getting a lot of attention. That's because the Iranian volleyball team has been doing exceptionally well. It beat the powerhouse Italian and Brazilian teams in the World League volleyball matches. Now, keep in mind that when it comes to sports in Iran, volleyball, or even soccer, isn't our strongest suit. Wrestling, yes, but volleyball, nah. So you can imagine how excited Iranians are to see these teams do so well at international levels. But a big part of their fan base is forced to watch from behind closed doors.
The reality is there is no legal issue. There is no legal ban. There is even no religious fatwa or any religious order against women attending sports stadiums.
It's not illegal. It's just forbidden, says Leila Mouri. She's an Iranian woman rights activist now living in New York. Women have long opposed the ban, she says. But in 2006, they got organized. They formed a group called Rusari Safidha, or Women in White Scarves.
They started this campaign specifically about their rights to attend sports stadiums. They used to wear white scarves, and they wrote their slogans on that white scarves.
It was a cheeky tactic. The idea was that if they wear their slogans on their head coverings, which they're required to wear in public, the morality police wouldn't be able to remove them. Mouri tells me about one of the sit-ins.
We rented a bus and went in front of the stadium. And I remember we had a very small TV with us. Symbolically, we sat in front of the Azadi Stadium and pretend that we are watching the match.
They asked to go inside the stadium.
They didn't let us in. They attacked us. And finally, they pushed us back and made us get into the bus and return.
Yes, Mouri says. For many women in Iran, getting to go to stadiums is about entertainment. After all, it's fun to watch live sports. But it's also about basic human rights. Stadiums are public spaces, and women should be allowed in there, just like men, she says. Some Iranian men agree. Filmmaker Jafar Panahi famously made a movie about a group of women who really want to get into a stadium to watch a soccer match. They even dress up as boys. Watching soccer in a stadium isn't a crime, one of the girls say. And if not being allowed in stadiums isn't bad enough, there's also a double standard when it comes to foreign women. If you're a woman from another country and your team is playing in Iran, you can enter a stadium.
As an Iranian, I think it is really humiliating that you are not allowed and you are not the same right in your own country as a foreign person has.
So what is the official explanation for the ban? Thing is, there isn't any. One argument goes something like this. Emotions in stadiums tend to run high. That leads to foul language, which is disrespectful to women. But activists like Mouri say it's more about limiting mingling of the sexes or the government's fear of mass gathering. Sitting in the stadium here in Massachusetts, I watch the fans get fired up after a goal, and I can't help but wonder about the absurdity of depriving women of joining in on the fun. The Iranian volleyball team could surely use the loud, ferocious cheers of its female supporters at the stadium in Tehran, which, by the way, is called Azadi, meaning freedom in Persian. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
And you're listening to The World on PRI Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity.com, personalized brain training programs developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving through games. More at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We've been dealing a lot lately on The World with this surge of unaccompanied children flowing across the U.S.-Mexico border. Tens of thousands of them have been fleeing violence in their home countries in Central America. They're also chasing rumors that children who cross the border are being allowed to stay in the U.S. President Obama has called it a humanitarian crisis, and he's expected to visit Texas this week. But a White House spokesperson has said the president won't be visiting the border for a firsthand look. I've got on the line from Alamo, Texas, near the border, community activist Michael Seifert. Tell me what the mood is like when you hear the president is coming to your state to shine a light on this crisis, but he's not going to the border.
Well, I think we're disappointed. The symbolism is huge about it. We had a meeting last week with some representatives from Congress, and all they could talk about was more boots on the ground and would not really directly address the issue that for us is foremost, which is the welfare of these kids.
Are you not concerned that if the president goes to the border, maybe his political opponents are going to use those images to just dramatize their points, whatever points they're trying to make?
I think absolutely. I mean, it's a minefield of an issue. Except, again, what's defeating the arguments back and forth are 6- and 7-year-olds standing there saying, help us.
Hmm. So what would you like the president to do, Michael?
We need to change the dialogue on it. And that's where the symbolic thing could come in with it. These are, at the end of the day, for all the ranting and raving, they are refugees. They are kids. They're coming because they're fleeing just awful violence.
And I noticed you called these kids refugees, not migrants. Make the distinction for us.
A refugee flees. All the families know the extraordinary danger of the trip through Mexico. I mean, it's one of the questions we get asked all the time, is that how can any parent let their child go north through Mexico to the United States? Well, the response is there really isn't anything viable on the ground. They're simply trying to save their kids' lives.
What about the argument, though, that there is a process to immigration, and until that process is in place, people coming to the U.S. illegally should simply be sent home?
There is a process, and one of the things that's part of that whole complicated process is a thing called temporary protective status that we've done in the past for people fleeing life-threatening events like earthquakes or the aftermaths of hurricanes. And that simply gives these folks, gives us actually a year or so, whatever time we want to set, to sit down and say, okay, let's look at this. Let's see what we can do about it. We've had a whole discussion about border security, and then we confuse that with immigration. We can't seem to separate out those two issues. So we have $18 billion spent on border security, and then a 6-year-old walks up to the port of entry and essentially defeats that entire effort. So for me, it's an opportunity to relook at this, just to step back and say, whoa, wait a minute. Whether there's the political will and moral imagination to do that is the question. And at the same time, it's a great opportunity. What a great moment to step up and say, you know, after all, we are the United States of America. We can deal with this.
Michael Seifert with the Equal Voice Network. He's a community activist on the Texas-Mexico border. Michael, thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Here's our final story on the world today. It's about opportunity, or rather the lack of opportunity, and how one man dealt with it. As in, when the rest of the world is playing a 6 or a 12-string guitar, don't think you failed if what you end up mastering is a 1-string guitar. This is about a Jamaican musician who goes by the name Brushy One String.
My given name is Andrew Anthony Chin. I'm a black Chinaman. But my real dad is Freddie McKay. But because he went away from I was a babe, my mom had this Chinaman that she was with, and he just owned me as his own, so I get his name also.
Father was legendary rocksteady musician Freddie McKay. His mother was a backup singer for Tina Turner. Seems the perfect background for a kid who wanted to make music. But his parents weren't around, hardly ever. So that was frustrating, but he persevered with his 1-string guitar, picking tunes off the radio to play.
Figure mining. Country song. Let's go like this. I went up in the country with my bag of Cali. I sit up on a DC. He want to own me. He say, no, DC, don't you touch my sensei. No, DC. And that was the first song I learned to play. And I run away to the next door city, which is in Linstead, where they call me Aki. Go to Linstead Market, not a quarter would sell.
Famous song.
Yeah, so I went to Linstead Market and I started seeing coming from a country, and the place was like full frenzy, and people was like, hey, there's a new madman in town and he plays a 1-string guitar. And I was like, yeah. And from that, the rest is history, man. Here I am.
What's really interesting is that the first thing I hear is your voice. You've got a fantastic voice. And you said your mother used to sing backup for Tina Turner, your dad, Freddie McKay.
Yeah.
So, you know, when you hear about kids whose parents are musicians, they usually have a lot of confidence.
Yeah.
Why didn't you seem to have that? I mean, it sounded like people made fun of you.
My dad wasn't there. And my mom, she wasn't there. My mom was like in England, Europe with Tina Turner. I know my mom when I was 31 years old.
For the first time?
For the first time. And I see my dad about 2 to 3 times in my whole entire life before he died. So I was always like a loner, always by myself.
One of his sole possessions as a kid was a guitar under his bed with just one string. And this is also where the brushy one-string story starts to get spackled with his own folklore. It started one night with a dream.
About 3 o'clock, I get a vision with a one-string guitar. This little short man came to me and said, I could take this guitar. I said to him, oh, I don't play Osman guitar. He said, you can play this one. I take the guitar, began to strung it, and start to play. Then the man turned 3 stars and vanished away, and the voice from the star say, take care of the guitar, and the guitar will take care of you. I wake in the morning, I say to my uncle, and he was like, that's only one string, you have a nightmare, nothing like that. And I was like, oh, I was doing it good, though. And his girlfriend said, oh, go and get your guitar, man, and wipe it off and play one string. Dream do come true.
Well, 5 million-plus hits on YouTube probably did not figure into those dreams, but it was one of the benefits. After Brushy posted a video of himself a year ago playing a funky number called Chicken in the Corn, just because the only guitar he had as a kid was the one under his bed with one string. You make do with what you got.
Chicken in the corn, and the corn can't grow, mama. Hey, when chicken in the corn, so the corn can't grow. Hey, when chicken in the corn, so the corn can't grow, mama. Hey, when chicken in the corn, so the corn
Brushy
can't
one
grow.
String. You've got to see this guy play, or rather, jam like a madman on his one string guitar. Check out the video I shot backstage when Brushy was in New York, including this song right here. That's at PRI.org. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman, back with you tomorrow.
On the corn can't grow, mama. Hey, when chicken the corn, so the corn can't grow. Hey, when chicken the corn, so the corn can't grow, mama. Hey, when chicken the corn, so the corn can't grow. Hey, one mile of Texas, one mile of Texas.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, supported in part by the PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors to the trust include the Tagney Jones Family Fund and the Rose Family Fund, by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs and their innovations to solve the world's most pressing problems at skoll.org, by the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Catherine Harris and the Hegart Foundation, John and Caroline Ballantyne, Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation, and Michael V. and Anne Cerisi, the Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs, by the Ford Foundation, and by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives. GatesFoundation.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.